Good morning, I'm Marty Moscoen. Welcome to Radio Times. Earlier this year, when President Obama outlined his proposal for reforming the country's healthcare system, the idea of a single-payer system was left out of the equation again. But there still is support for the idea, including in the U.S. Congress, from Representative John Conyers and Senator Bernie Sanders, among others. And there are, not surprisingly, critics of the idea. So today on Radio Times, how would a single-payer healthcare system work? Would it fix the problems that ail the current system, like costs, quality of care, and the millions of uninsured? And what's wrong with the idea? Let me introduce our guests. Steffi Woolhandler is a practicing physician and associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. In 1986, she helped to found Physicians for a National Health Program and serves on the board. Steffi Woolhandler, nice to have you with us on Radio Times. Good morning.
Good morning.
Robert Moffitt is director of the Heritage Foundation's Center for Health Policy Studies. He's a former senior official in the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and the Office of Personnel Management during the Reagan administration. And Robert Moffitt, nice to have you with us on Radio Times as well. Good morning.
Good morning to you and Steffi.
And Steph, good morning. And Steffi, I do want to begin with you, and I will get to you, Robert Moffitt. In your most concise way, Steffi Woolhandler, describe for us what your organization proposes as a single-payer system.
Well, single-payer is like an expanded and improved traditional Medicare for all. That is, the government, through taxes, collects the money for health care, and then there's a program that pays all medical bills for all medically necessary services, similar to the original Medicare, only in this case we would make it start the day you're born and continue throughout your life, and we would cover everything. We wouldn't have gaps like traditional Medicare.
So we're talking about a program that the private sector still delivers the care, but it's paid through government.
Well, private sector hospitals and doctors can stay private. What we would not allow is private health insurance. And the reason for that is private health insurance with multiple payers and multiple procedures is a driver of very high administrative costs. Administrative costs for healthcare in the United States consume 31% of total health spending, and in a place like Canada, they consume half that much. So by reducing our administrative costs to the low level that Canada and other single-payer systems have, we could save about $370 billion a year just in paperwork costs. And, of course, that's the money that we would need to provide universal health insurance, but also to improve the health insurance of people who now have only partial coverage and have gaps, co-payments, things they really can't afford. So single payer lets you cover everyone, improve coverage for everyone, and pay for it out of the existing system just by eliminating the high administrative costs.
But how would you, how would that be paid for? How would an individual get that care, and how would that money be deducted?
The same way that you get Medicare, which is it is paid for through taxes. Doesn't mean it's free. It just means we pay for it through taxes, and taxes are much more oriented around ability to pay. Rich people pay more, and lower-income people pay less, but everybody pays something.
So it would be taken out of someone's paycheck?
You could do, like Medicare, you could use an income. Medicare is a combination of a payroll tax and an income tax, general tax revenues, so you could use some combination of taxes.
Well, Bob Moffitt, let me get you in on the conversation. What's wrong with that?
Oh, it sounds terrific. I mean, the idea has an appealing simplicity. It's logically coherent, and Steffi has been a champion of this idea for many years. You pay the government taxes. Actually, they're going to be very big taxes, and the government gives you health care, either directly or indirectly. The doctors, the hospitals, and the health care providers, in effect, become agents of the government. It's relatively simple. Of course, the promise is that we'll have high-quality health care. It will be free at the point of service, and it will be efficient, and we will get rid of administrative costs. The problem is that, in practice, it's not so simple. If health care becomes, in effect, an entitlement, as it is in Medicare today, what economists call a free good, well, free goods have certain invariable characteristics. With a free good, if health care is indeed a free good, then, of course, the economic demand for the free good is literally unlimited. But for unlimited demand at any given point in time, that free good, that demand, must collide with a limited supply. And what this means is that government officials, not doctors, not patients, are ultimately going to have to make very, very big decisions about who gets care, how they get care, when they get care, and under what circumstances they get care. So the key decisions in such a system, in other words, are ultimately their political decisions or budgetary decisions. They're not even medical decisions or conventional economic decisions. It seems to me that we do have experience with Medicare, and the experience with Medicare financially is not good. Medicare has enormous unfunded liabilities, and it routinely shifts costs into the private sector.
Let me get you to respond to that, Steffi Woolhandler. As a critique of your idea, what do you say?
Well, I disagree with many of the points. I disagree fundamentally with this idea that there's unlimited demand for health care. As a doctor, I think of what I do in my office. I do pap smears. I order colonoscopies. And no one in their right mind wants more of those things than they really need. There's an unlimited demand for health, but that's not the same thing as an unlimited demand for health care. Every patient wants the amount of health care that they really need to stay healthy. Nobody is asking for these extra colonoscopies and pap smears. I think a lot of the demand is actually driven by doctors and hospitals and not driven by patients. And to put the onus on patients and punish them, forcing them to pay out of their own pocket, is completely inappropriate. The doctors and hospitals need to be much more careful about only ordering things that really improve patients' health and not the excessive use of tests and procedures that is, as Bob is implying, a major driver of cost. It's not the only driver. We feel administrative costs are a big driver as well.
Well, let me get you to talk about administrative costs, Bob Moffitt. And Steffi cited some statistics, and I think most people in this country agree that we pay a lot of money to administer health care in this country. Do you agree with that?
Yes and no. I mean, Medicare's administrative costs, for example, which is the model for what Steffi is proposing, are in fact technically low. They're between 1% and 2%. Right. And I remember when I was at the Department of Health and Human Services, when we were asked that question before Ways and Means, that's usually what we told the committee. The problem is, though, is that Medicare is not as administratively simple as a lot of people make it out to be. Medicare is governed by thousands of pages of rules and regulations and guidelines that make determinations about what doctors, you know, what procedures will be reimbursed, and specifically under what specific conditions they may be reimbursed. This is not a simple matter, and that's why the regulatory regime in Medicare is so huge. What we have is we have administrative costs in Medicare, but the administrative costs are usually hidden. They don't show up in the budget the same way. What happens, in effect, is these administrative costs are shifted on to doctors and hospitals and other health care providers, nursing homes and so on, and they have to bear all the transactional costs of complying with this regulatory regime.
Well,
there was a recent study by PricewaterhouseCoopers, for example, a few years ago, that looked at the administrative cost of Medicare in terms of its paperwork burden on American hospitals and providers. And they did this for the American Hospital Association. What they found is that for every hour of care delivered to a Medicare patient, about a half hour was spent by the hospital staff complying with Medicare paperwork requirements. Now, that is a real administrative cost, but it does not show up on the budget.
Well, let me turn back to you, Steffi Woolhandler, as a practicing physician, and compare then for our listeners what it costs to, in your office, let's say, to fill out the paperwork for Medicare compared to private health insurance companies.
Okay. Well, at our place, we consider Medicare an easier payer to work with. But the bigger question is that Medicare is in the U.S. is only one of multiple payers. So you get a lot of complexity because they want to make sure they only pay for the Medicare patient. They don't pay for the guy in the next bed who's on private insurance. In a true single-payer system, everyone, like in Canada, everyone has the same kind of insurance. And that allows the single payer to give the hospital a global budget. So in Canada, a hospital negotiates with the province for their entire budget for the year, and then 1/12 of that budget is deposited in the hospital's bank account every month. There's no billing at all for individual patients in a single-payer system. The hospital gets their, $1 billion a year or whatever it is they get, and they get a twelfth of it, they don't have to send a bill for Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Jones. They don't have to figure out whether the IV fluid went to Mrs. Smith or Mrs. Jones, other than for medical reasons. But there's nothing billing related to the utilization of any sort of service for an individual patient. So by having that global budget, you get even greater administrative efficiency than what Bob Moffitt is talking about. And that's why Canada, their hospital overhead is half of what hospital overhead is in the United States.
Well, Bob Moffitt, let me turn back to you, and this is just based on other programs that we've done on Radio Times, looking at our healthcare system. And we hear from doctors all the time that to manage our healthcare system, they have to have more administrative staff than they have, you know, nurses and healthcare aides who are actually delivering the care.
Right, and Medicare is one of the chief contributors to the headaches and the paperwork problems of doctors and hospitals. And Medicaid is such a horrible program that they have to deal with that, in fact, one out of five doctors today won't even take Medicaid, not simply because the reimbursements are so low. It's about 56% of the private payment, but because they have to deal with the Medicare bureaucracy and they have to deal with the Medicare Medicaid paperwork. Look, you can set up a global budget, and if you're going to be serious about it, you say, look, this is what we're going to spend for health care. We're going to spend X, and that X is what, you know, we have decided will be spent. And in the Canadian system, you know, that's it, basically. There is no private options. You cannot go out of the system and sign up for private health insurance. So that's the way it is. It's not like, for example, Great Britain. It's a straight budget that applies to the healthcare system. You just got to hope that the demand doesn't outrun the supply. Government officials, however, can't control economic demand. They only can control the supply of services. And the way they control the supply of services is basically by restricting those services in the face of rising demand. And that affects access to care, and it, of course, undermines quality of care for individuals and families.
Are you talking about rationing?
No, I'm talking about rationing through global budgets, yes.
Steffi Wilhander, we've got about 45 seconds before our break, but respond to that criticism, if you will.
There's an assumption that more is always better. Mr. Moffitt is saying that more is always better. But in the United States, we have excessive use of things like cardiac cath, excessive use of CT scans of the chest and abdomen, excessive use of new drugs that have not been proven safe. You want a healthcare financing system that encourages the right amount of use of technology and drugs, and not one that just says, hey, whatever the demand is or whatever the doctors want to order, we're going to pay for, because that is not in the interest of population health.
And that's Steffi Wilhander, one of our two guests today on Radio Times. She's one of the founders of Physicians for a National Health Program. She serves on the board. She's a practicing physician, also associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. Also with us is Robert Moffitt, director of the Heritage Foundation Center for Health Policy Studies. And we are talking today on Radio Times about a single-payer system. Is this the system that would work for the U.S.? You're hearing two perspectives. We want to hear from you at 1-888-477-9499. We'll be right back.
Karen Treatment Centers support WHYY. Erratic behavior, mood swings, troubles at school or work. These could be signs of drug and alcohol addiction. More information can be found at Karen.org. CARON.org.
You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. It's 10:20. In the second hour at 11, Princeton and Harvard-educated Marine Donovan Campbell describes his combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan in his new book entitled Joker One, a Marine Platoon Story of Courage, Leadership, and Brotherhood. The WHYY forecast, periods of rain perhaps into early this evening. This afternoon's high 50 degrees, clearing overnight, low falling back to 39. This is WHYY.
This week in This American Life, who hasn't this happened to? A woman freezes her dead father, hoping that hundreds of years from now he'll be unfrozen and brought back to life, and she donates the capsule that has his body inside of it to a cryonics organization run by this guy.
That's probably the only thing that I am somewhat ashamed about, that I didn't tell her that I was going to put three more people in there.
This week.
Tonight at 9 on WHYY.
Arden Theatre Company supports WHYY and presents Something Intangible. Scott Greer and Ian Merle Peake star in this story about two very different brothers running a movie studio in 1941.
Tickets at ardentheater.org.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscow-Wayne. We are talking about a single-payer health care system. Is it or isn't it the solution to our health care crisis? Our guests are Bob Moffitt and Steffi Woolhandler, and we got just looks like a full bank of calls here at 1-888-477-9499. Steffi Woolhandler, let me go back to you. I'll go back to you, Bob Moffitt, and then we'll get to our callers. Under your program, Steffi, would a patient then have the choice of any doctor that they wanted?
Yes. A Canadian patient can take their card and go to any doctor in Canada. They can go to any hospital in Canada. They can self-refer to a specialist. And that's certainly a whole lot more freedom of choice than most Americans have through restricted HMOs and insurance plans.
And would a doctor get a salary from the government, or would they make more or less money than they're making today?
Well, I think some doctors might choose to get a salary, but in Canada, most doctors choose to be paid on a fee-for-service basis. They have a binding fee schedule, but the more patients they see, the more they'll get paid. So they do use a fee-for-service system.
To you, Robert Moffitt, I mean, at least under the system that Steffi Woolhandler is describing, that patients would get choice. Isn't that a good thing?
Oh, it's a choice of doctor, but you basically, all the decisions with regard to what is covered, what is not covered, what you get and what you don't get, what your medical procedures and treatments are, what kind of drugs are available in the government formulary, all that's determined by the government. The doctors are not agents of the patient in a single-payer government-run system. Basically, the doctors or agents of the government.
But under today's system, doctors are told what to do by private health insurance companies.
That's true. And I would make the point that I agree with Steffi that there's an awful lot wrong with the American insurance market. I would change it rather dramatically, as she knows. I do not think at the end of the day that the current system where you are told what to do either by government officials or by employers or by managed care executives, what you can and cannot have, is the best option. The best option for you is to be able to pick and choose the kind of health care you want and that you think is best for you.
Steffi, your program has been around for more than 20 years, since 1986. President Obama did convene a group earlier this year to talk about health insurance and how to rein in some of the costs, how to reform it, but the single-payer system was not represented at that table. Why not?
Well, actually, what happened is single payer was initially not represented, but we threatened demonstrations in Washington and actually at his White House summit, and actually held demonstrations at the five regional summits. And single payer representatives were invited into the room, and in many cases, they were outside as well. So there has been an ability to push the Obama administration to listen at least a little bit to single-payer voices. I think if we can push the Obama administration a little bit, it indicates that we can actually push them a lot. Mr. Obama is a centrist, and by building a real movement for single-payer on his left, we can move the center and, I think, move the debate. So I would encourage any of your callers or listeners who want to get involved in health care, now is really a good time to be telling your political representatives, telling your organizations, speaking as loudly as possible that you want single payer.
But why did you have to threaten to get yourself in the room there?
Well, that represents the power of the private health insurance industry. Spokesmen for the private health insurance industry have said things like, we are completely and totally opposed to national health insurance. It's a life or death issue for us. So we know that the private health insurance industry has lobbied long and hard to exclude the single-payer option. We need to be building a popular movement to put that back on the table. And, you know, to be honest, many, many people are very unhappy with the healthcare system. It's not just 47 million uninsured people. It's tens of millions more who buy private health insurance in good faith, and then when they get sick, find out their insurance doesn't work, that they're going to be forced into bankruptcy by their medical problems despite having insurance because there are gaps, co-payments, deductibles, their insurance gets canceled. So when you start looking at people who are actually sick, many of them have very negative experiences with the healthcare finance system, and we think should be letting their elected representatives know what they think.
To you, Bob Moffitt, because you have talked about your concerns about a system leading to some kind of rationing, but nonetheless, I'm looking at the National Coalition on Healthcare, which has looked at some of these numbers. In 2007, this country spent $2.4 trillion, that's $7,900 per person, on healthcare system. Projecting into the future, they're saying something like $4.3 trillion to be spent on healthcare. Aren't we at some point going to have to consider, if not rationing, some way of controlling these costs?
Oh, I think we should. And I think, just make it clear here, my opposition to a single-payer system is not an endorsement of the status quo. I think the health insurance markets are not functioning properly. There's far too much consolidation. They're distorted. They're inefficient. I think the costs are much higher than they should be. Quality is not what it should be in many cases. Far too many Americans are uninsured. And lower-income working families are struggling to hold on to the insurance they've got. So, that is not an issue here. I think the question is, what are we going to do about it? You got to remember that one of the reasons why Barack Obama was not enthusiastic about embracing a single-payer system is that most Americans are insured today. 85% of the population, roughly, give or take a percentage, is covered by insurance, either through the public programs or through private insurance. And the evidence is overwhelming. 82% of Americans in survey research indicate that they think that their health care plan is either excellent or good. It may very well be that some people have a bad experience with insurance, but it's also true that people, especially if they have good insurance, usually have very, very good experience with the system. So, I don't think there's a groundswell in the United States for people to say, let's get rid of all our private insurance and embrace something that looks like a government health insurance program. There doesn't seem to be a groundswell for that. In fact, the president has gone repeatedly on the air throughout the campaign and said repeatedly, if you have health insurance that you have today, if you like the health plan you have today, you'll be able to keep it. I don't think he's going to be able to keep that promise with his health plan, but I don't think there's a groundswell. But I agree with Steffi that, it ought to be debated. I would like to see John Conyers and the Democratic leadership put that bill on the floor and have a full-scale debate on a single-payer system. I think we ought to do that.
Is there a groundswell, Steffi? And then we'll get to our callers.
Well, if you look at polls, if you ask people what I think is a very valid question, which is, would you support a system like Medicare that covered everyone through health insurance, public health insurance paid for by taxes, that enjoys majority support among the American people. Polls among physicians also show majority physicians support national health insurance. So certainly the sentiment is there. What's been lacking, I think, is leadership at the top. So we've gotten some excellent leadership from Congressman Conyers, Congressman Kucinich, but at the top ranks of the Democratic Party, we really haven't seen Kennedy or Obama step forward and say, I'm going to lead us into a Medicare for All or single-payer-like system. So I think the population wants it. We're not going to get leadership from the top, so we're going to have to rely on popular mobilization to get this. And, I really think so many people are unhappy with the healthcare system. Often people get by private insurance, they're happy with it till they get sick. And then about half of all bankruptcies in the United States are due to medical illness and medical bills. And the majority of people forced into medical bankruptcy have health insurance at the onset of the illness that bankrupts them. So medical bankruptcy is not primarily a problem of the uninsured. It's primarily a problem of people who had insurance, what they thought was good insurance, only to find that when they got sick, things were not covered.
Well, let's find a very unscientific sample, but let's find out from our listeners whether you support the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. Steffi Wohlhander helped to found an organization called Physicians for a National Health Program, serves on the board of that organization. She's a practicing physician, associate professor of medicine at Harvard. Also with us is Robert Moffitt, director of the Heritage Foundation Center for Health Policy Studies. He's a former senior official at the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services and in the Office of Personnel Management, and that was during the Reagan administration. A full bank of calls. Let's see what some of our listeners have to say about the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. And we have Joanne from Medford. Joanne, go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi, thank you very much for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I wanted to ask you, given that you, and this is particularly relevant because I don't have insurance on myself, though I do have it on my son. So my question is, given that you don't want this mandate to be unfunded, how are you going to take the tax from unemployed persons? Are you going to more fully mandate unemployment and its related programs? And given that these people don't have that much money to begin with, how can they afford a, say, 40% chunk of tax or whatever it is taken out of their income for these services? Are we really going to be giving the services, or are we just saying that we want to do it?
And to you, Joanne, just a very quick question. You said you have health insurance for your child. Do you have it? Do you have health insurance for yourself now?
No, I do not.
You do not.
I am a full-time student, musician, single mother, and I have not had insurance for myself for over 10 years.
Okay. Well, let me get to Siffy Wilhandler to respond to that. I mean, what do you do about people who are either uninsured or, frankly, too poor to pay for health insurance?
Thanks for the question, because I think I wasn't clear. Everyone, under a single-payer system, everyone's covered. So if you don't pay your taxes, the IRS might come after you, but it doesn't actually matter in terms of health coverage. Everyone is covered for health care from the day they're born to the day they die, and the entire system is funded out of taxes. So for a very low-income person who doesn't pay taxes, and a single mother, I think, wouldn't pay any taxes until your income was about $16,000 a year, that they would still have complete access to the health care system.
What do you think about that, Bob Moffitt?
Well, it's just another argument. I mean, the thing is that if you want a very, very high tax system, we can do it. I mean, the British and the Europeans are paying over 50% of their income in taxes in many parts of the world, you know, where these kinds of programs exist. You're talking about very high taxes. I know that the argument was that, you know, we can, you know, deliver high-quality health care that is going to be relatively inexpensive. When a single-payer proposal was made in the state of Maryland, where I live, and I was on the Maryland Health Care Commission, the proponents of that said, yeah, we can do this. We can have universal coverage in the state of Maryland. It's just going to require a payroll tax of 9.5%. At which point, the Speaker of the House, who was a Democrat, said, well, you know, we can have a single-payer system in the state of Maryland, just that we won't have any employers left.
So, but I mean, obviously, states have to balance their budget, so they have certain limitations in coming up with their own unique
program.
Absolutely.
And if you have it at the national level, what you're going to say is that you're going to have a government-run healthcare system that's going to be financed by a payroll tax, but at the same time, the financing of that system is going to have to compete with national defense, with education, with the environment spending, with energy spending, anything else that's coming along, plus the existing entitlements.
But it's
going to be a challenge.
No,
right now we pay for Medicare, but we really don't really pay for Medicare. We have a situation where Medicare has got artificially low payments for doctors and hospitals. We shift cost into the private sector, where people in the private sector today are paying higher health insurance premiums, about $1,700 per family, and then we shift the cost onto the future generations, where we have a situation where we have these promised benefits amounting to about $36 trillion that nobody knows how we're going to pay for.
But what do you do about the almost 50 million people in this country, like Joanne, who don't have health insurance?
Oh, I absolutely have total sympathy with Joanne. I think that we should have universal coverage. I do agree with that. I think what we need to do is we have to expand health insurance coverage. I would do it two ways. I would fix the tax treatment of health insurance, eliminate the unfairness and inequities in the tax code that really impose a penalty on people like Joanne who try to buy health insurance on their own. And for low-income people, I would directly subsidize them to get health insurance.
Well, let me
go
jump
ahead, Stephanie.
In here. I want to clarify something. Under single payer, the total amount that a household pays for health care on average is not going to go up. What's going to happen is instead of paying taxes and premiums and out-of-pocket costs, it's all going to be collected as taxes. Okay, but the total amount that the average household spends is actually going to be flat, but you're going to get a lot more in that everyone's going to be covered and there's not going to be copayments and deductibles, and that's because of the administrative savings.
And just to underscore that, Stephanie, I was reading again from this National Coalition on Healthcare, the average family of four today, the cost for their health insurance is $12,700. Is that?
Well, there's $12,700 for their health insurance, but of course that family of four has probably already paid payroll taxes for Medicare, income taxes that go into general revenues that support Medicare and Medicaid, state taxes for Medicaid, millage taxes for county hospitals, and then co-payments and deductibles. So the average family of four, actually the cost of their care on average is $32,000 a year. And believe me, the average family's paying it. No one's paying it for you. You know, it's on an average, that's actually what we're paying for health care in this country.
Let me get back to our callers. Joanne, thanks for the call. Let me see what Nick from Doylestown has to say. Hi, Nick. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi, Marty. Thanks for taking my call.
You're welcome.
As a healthcare employee, I just have one concern about the difference between the single-payer versus multiple-payer system. And I guess that general question is how a single-payer system is going to affect innovation of new technologies, whether it's pharmaceuticals, medical devices, and ultimately how that change in innovation is going to affect patients and quality of healthcare. It seems like the quality of care is something that's kind of come up multiple times in this conversation. And as an employee in a company, while I'm concerned about how that's going to affect my business, ultimately, it affects the patient care as well. So that's one of my biggest concerns, and I just wanted to get the opinion of both the callers on whether or not they think it's going to really affect innovation and patient care.
Nick, I appreciate the call to Radio Times. I'm going to start again with you, Steffi Wilhandler, and then to you, Bob Moffitt. Steffi, go ahead.
Okay. Well, when we look at quality, we see that other developed countries with single-payer systems actually have better health outcomes. That is, Canadians live 2 to 3 years longer than Americans. Their infant mortality rate is much lower than that in the U.S., and that's true of other countries like Australia and those in northwestern Europe with single-payer systems. So certainly at the outcomes level, the looks like the health system's working better. But even if we compare specific treatments for individual diagnoses, as was done in a meta-analysis that appeared last year in the journal Open Medicine, the quality of care in Canada looks like it's at least as good as the quality of care in the United States. In fact, death rates were about 5% lower in Canada than in the United States. That there was a statistical issue called heterogeneity, which we don't need to go into, but the conclusion was care is at least as good in Canada as it is in the United States. I'm an internist. I take care of very sick patients. Many of them, unfortunately, still die from their illnesses. I'm a big believer in innovation. We need innovations in cancer care, heart disease care, diabetes. So I'm a big supporter of innovation. I think by far the most efficient way to support innovation is through the NIH budget, through our federal budget for scientific investigation. That's much, much more efficient than, you know, pouring hundreds of billions, you know, extra into the healthcare system and hoping that some of it trickles down to innovation.
And Bob Moffitt, again, we're almost up on a break here, but can you speak quickly to this notion of innovation?
Yeah, the United States is a leader of technological innovation in medicine and medical care. We are the global destination for patients who are in pursuit of high-quality, advanced medical care. That's beyond dispute. We are the home base of a pharmaceutical revolution that has revolutionized the capacity of doctors to combat disease. So, no, I mean, if you go to a single-payer system, you will certainly, once you establish a global budget, you will say to those people in the healthcare sector who of the economy who invest in new science and new technology, this is not an area to invest in. Innovation will decline, and you will not have the kind of breakthroughs that we have had routinely in the United States.
And we are debating the idea of a single-payer healthcare system. That's Bob Moffitt, director of the Heritage Foundation Center for Health Policy Studies, and Steffi Wilhandler. She's a physician, also helped to found an organization back in 1986 called Physicians for a National Health Program. 1-888-477-9499. What's your position on a single-payer healthcare system? We'll be right back.
Medford Lees proudly supports WHYY, a Quaker-related community for those age 55-plus with campuses in Medford and Lumberton, New Jersey. Medford Lees features arboretum settings, a wide range of residential home designs from townhouses to garden-style apartments, varied contract options, a self-governing residence association, and comprehensive on-site wellness and health services. Further details at 800-331-4302 or medfordlees.org.
It's 10:40. You're listening to Radio Times on WHYY. In the second hour at 11, Marine Donovan Campbell describes his combat deployments in Iraq and Afghanistan. His new book is called Joker One, a Marine Platoon story of courage, leadership, and brotherhood. One more rainy day. The WHYY forecast, a high of 50 degrees this afternoon, down to 39 overnight under clearing skies. Sunny tomorrow, milder, high all the way to 60 degrees.
I'm Jonathan Goldstein, and this week on Wiretap, Gregor decides to take me shopping for a brand new wardrobe. And the first item on his list?
A bra for jogging, for support up top. You're going to need a bra.
I'm not wearing a brassiere.
Until you firm up, you need a jog bra, and don't you fight me on this one. Excuse me, miss, can we get two jog bras over here? For this guy. I think he's an A-cup.
That's this week's Wiretap from PRI, Public Radio International.
Tomorrow night at 9 o'clock on WHYY.
This is Radio Times here on WHYY in Philadelphia. I'm Marty Moscoen talking with Robert Moffat and Steffi Woolhandler, getting two very interesting and in certain ways different, although there's some consensus about certainly what's wrong with this country's healthcare system and some of the pros and cons of a single-payer healthcare system. Bob Moffat, let me just get you to respond to something else that our listener said, our caller, I should say, said before the break, and this is this question about health outcomes. We do spend, we all agree, we spend a lot of money in this country on health care. And as we all know, I'm not saying we're a sick population, but we have a lot of very unhealthy people in this country as well.
Well, yes. I mean, there is some evidence that, in fact, we are sicker as a group than Western Europeans, and particularly from chronic diseases like diabetes, which is now at an epidemic level. The reason why that is the case has to do, in many cases, with lifestyle, what we eat, the lack of exercise, the over-drinking, smoking, all these things come to mind. Nutrition, public health, personal behavior, behavioral influences often have a big impact on whether or not we're sick. However, in terms of medical outcomes, I think we've made huge progress. If you look at some of the research that's come out from the Centers for Disease Control, for example, since 1999 alone, death from cardiovascular diseases, heart attack and stroke, have declined by 25%. Well, that's a stunning performance. We are making serious progress against cancer in the United States. The death rate from cancer has been declining about 2% per year. And the survival rate for early stage breast cancer, which is a serious problem, something that is striking one out of eight women in the United States, largely because of early detection and rapid treatment in the United States, very rapid responsive treatment, the survival rate is about 95% for early stage breast cancer. So we are making progress in this area. I'm not going to say that there are not gaps in quality. There are certainly gaps in quality, and I think we know how to fix them, but doesn't necessarily mean that we have to turn over the entire healthcare sector of the economy to the federal government.
Go ahead, Steffi Woolhandler.
Well, Bob is painting a very dire picture of single payer that doesn't match anything that people who live in those countries actually experience. I work with Canadian doctors all the time. I'm in an organization called American College of Physicians that has Canadian chapters, and they don't tell me they're agents of the government. They feel that they have a lot of independence. In fact, studies show that Canadian doctors feel they have more clinical independence than American doctors report. Similarly, there's innovation in Canada. There's innovation in Western Europe. When you look on a per capita basis at the production of medical articles, scientific articles, the production per capita of those articles in Western Europe and in Canada is actually higher than in the United States. Now, of course, we're bigger, but on a per capita basis, they do their share of innovation. So you can still have innovation. You can still have doctors who work for patients in a single-payer system. A lot of my patients have Medicare, and believe me, I don't feel like an agent of the government when I take care of a Medicare patient. I feel like I work for my patients, and that's really important.
And Steffi, just a follow-up. Are you saying the model that your organization supports is closer to Canada than any other country?
It is actually closer to Canada. There are many countries have nonprofit national health insurance. In fact, until recently, every developed country other than the United States had nonprofit national health insurance. All of their healthcare financing systems work better than ours does. But our group has tended to talk the most about Canada because, we're a physician group. We have about 15,000 physician members, and many of us have colleagues in Canada, know about Canada. Culturally, we're similar to Canada. So that has been the easiest single-payer model to explain and to work around.
Let me get back to our callers. We've got, looks like, Tyler joining us from West Philadelphia. Hi, Tyler. Go ahead. You're on the air.
Hi. Thanks for taking my call.
You're very welcome.
I feel like in our country, healthcare in large part is becoming, or we are trying to make it become, the way to avoid the consequences of our bad personal choices. So I want to eat at McDonald's my whole life and then have a cath or heart surgery when I grow old. I want to eat poorly and then have medication to take care of my diabetes. I want to make poor choices and then have healthcare fix or take away the consequences. And I wonder if having what would appear to many people to be free healthcare, if it was financed completely through taxes, would increase the incentive or take away the disincentive to be irresponsible and thus increase the total spending in the country on health care.
Tyler, I'm going to put your question first to Bob Moffitt. And Bob, you had mentioned some of these lifestyle choices, and then Steffi Wohlhandler, we'll hear from you as well. Bob Moffitt, go ahead.
Well, if you think at the end of the day, it's called moral hazard, if you think at the end of the day you can do anything you want, there will be no consequences, and the taxpayer is going to pick up the bill, that's certainly not an incentive for you to take responsible action. I mean, that's absolutely true. We have a situation, in, as I said earlier, and I, you know, we just brushed on it, but I mean, the fact of the matter is, one of the reasons why that roughly, you know, 75 cents out of every dollar that is spent in the United States is spent on chronic disease is largely because of our lifestyle choices in many cases. If we had, young and old and like, if we started, you know, making behavioral changes, if we started seeing serious reductions in the abuse of alcohol, reductions in smoking, a reduction in the consumption of saturated fat, we saw more exercise, if people did the right thing, as Wilford Brimley said, and ate their oatmeal every morning, that would have a very positive influence on mortality and morbidity. But I can tell you, it's absolutely true. If people think, for example, that, you know, health care is something that is to be, is not your personal responsibility, but ultimately the responsibility of the government, you are going to shift costs, basically, onto the taxpayers. Everything is going to be a lot more expensive. And the only way that they will control cost, as Steffi said, is they'll decide what the demand will be. They will plan for meeting that demand, and if that demand exceeds what the government says it will pay for, then you will not get the care that you think you need.
Go ahead, Steffi Wohlhandler.
I'm completely opposed to this idea. I tell my patients to exercise. I want people to eat right. I help them stop smoking. But it's not the job of the healthcare system to punish people because they ate too many cheeseburgers. I mean, we're human beings and we take care of each other when we're sick, and we don't sit around, you know, punishing other people because their lifestyle wasn't perfect. I just want to point out that many people are not really making choices. 90% of all cigarette smokers in the United States, 90% became addicted while they were still children, okay? And many of these poor eating habits and habits and obesity are established when people are children, and to say that that's a choice and not a social issue or public health issue is really blaming the victim.
Well, but picking up on this idea of lifestyle choices, and I think we can all agree that the people in this country have made lifestyle choices that have caused them health problems and in some cases, expensive health problems. But Steffi Wohlhandler, looking at a single-payer system, I mean, how would that intervene to address that problem of unhealthy lifestyle choices?
Well, the most important way to address unhealthy lifestyle choices is through public health, and we've advocated spending more on prevention and particularly public health ways of preventing things. So, for instance, there's been wonderful work done in the city of New York in terms of lowering the salt and calorie content of fast food. We need to really control the tobacco industry and prevent them from peddling their wares to children, who represent 90% of all the new addicts in this country. We need to make it easier for people to get exercise. That means we have to modify people's hours of work and their transportation, and put parks in cities, put recreational facilities so people have the option of having a healthier lifestyle. And those things are very, very cost effective. You'll save a lot of money by preventing diabetes and heart failure and high blood pressure in the long run if you spend some more money on parks and recreation and facilitating healthy food choices in the short run.
And we could do a whole hour on this, but Bob Moffitt, as you said, that this is a problem for this country, but focusing on prevention, public health, is that the way to go?
Well, I don't see anything wrong with promoting good public health. I think the anti-smoking campaigns that were done through the Advertising Council actually have had an impact. Smoking has been reduced. The problem now is that some young people are picking it up, and that's a difficulty. But look, at the end of the day, I mean, the question is, you know, who's ultimately responsible for your health care? I mean, is it going to be your employer? Is it going to be the government? Is it going to be some managed care executive? Or is it going to be you? My view is at the end of the day, you are ultimately to be responsible for your health care. That means that you should exercise your intellect and your free will to do what is right. Now, having said that, I do think we ought to make some structural changes in the insurance market. One thing that I think that should be done is if people insist on smoking, they should pay higher insurance rates. This is a free country. If you want to smoke like a chimney, you should be able to do it. But at the same time, you should not be able to shift your cost onto the rest of us. With regard to health insurance itself, if people enroll in preventive health care or wellness programs, if they they pursue a regime of diet and exercise, there should be premium discounts for people who do that, so that they actually get a break on their premiums. One of the innovations in Switzerland, for example, is they have 5-year contracts, and if people actually pursue wellness programs, you actually get a bonus back at the end of that period for participating in prevention and wellness. That makes a lot of economic sense. We ought to be sensible about this, and we can solve a lot of these problems, but it doesn't mean at the end of the day that all of these problems are going to be solved by Washington.
Tyler, thanks for the call. Sounds like you want to say something, Steffi, and then we'll get to Sean.
Well, I think that as someone who treats tobacco addiction all the time, what Bob is saying represents a profound misunderstanding of the concept of addiction. Virtually all of my tobacco addicted patients want to stop. Most of them have tried several times. Yes, they need help. They need medical help. They need to do whatever they can. But to punish them further, they're already going to die 8 years earlier than the rest of us. They're already having all sorts of other problems, from wrinkles to bad breath to dental problems because of it. Most of them want to stop and can't, and it's not the role of the healthcare system to be punishing people.
Again, I know we could do a whole hour on this segment alone. Let me get Sean from, looks like, Roseville, California to join us. Hi, Sean. Go ahead. You're on Radio Times.
Hi. I just wanted to say my wife and I are both in the healthcare industry. She is a physical therapist, and I am a contractor who specializes in handicap modifications for patients. We completely disagree with a single-payer system. And the most recent example we have is here in Northern California, there is a small hospital, or actually a huge hospital system, that they own the hospitals, they own the clinics, they own the diagnostic services, and they own the doctors. And one of my wife's patients recently, who I'm getting ready to do a lot of home modifications for, went to her doctor and complained about headaches. Over the course of 3 weeks, the doctor did nothing but said, oh, this is, you know, late effects of menopause, and this is that, and this is the other. And he never ordered any kind of diagnostic test for budgetary constraints, and ended up she had a brain infection that ultimately led to 2 very serious brain surgeries, and now she's handicapped and in a wheelchair for the rest of her life. And everybody who works in my wife's facility and deals with this large hospital corporation agrees that this would have been prevented if she had had a PPO instead of being a part of this big hospital group.
Well, Sean, let me take your point, only because I'm watching the clock, and there are, you know, there are anecdotes for everything, and this is obviously a very tragic one, but let me get Steffi Woolhandler to respond to that. Steffi, your thoughts?
Well, it sounds like this was a problem with a private system and not really a problem with a tax funded system. I don't know any individual circumstances, but I do want to say that if you do imaging on every patient who comes in with a headache, you're going to be causing an awful lot of cancer, okay, because you're going to be putting a lot of radiation and high electrical fields around patients. So there has to be some judgment about when you image and when you don't, and that's really all I can say about that case.
Sean, thanks for calling into Radio Times, and I am watching the clock here. Steffi Woolhandler, as you said, you know, this has been an uphill battle for your organization, and you were, after some threats, I guess, allowed at least in the door to talk to the Obama administration. How are you going to get some movement on this idea of single payer?
Well, people really need to be out there saying they want single payer. If their congressman is in the district, go visit them in their district and tell them you support single payer. If you're at a public meeting, stand up and ask the question. If you're part of a labor union or a church or a synagogue or a school organization, try to get programs on single payer. Try to get the idea out to the populace, because this is really about building a movement. If you want more information, you can go to the Physicians for a National Health Program website. You can probably find it by Googling any of those words, but it is www.pnhp.org, and there's lots of information, tools, slideshows, PowerPoints, contacts for people who want to get involved.
And to you, Robert Moffitt, we've been focusing on a single-payer system, but I wonder, looking even at some of the problems that the auto industry is having in Detroit and the costs of having private insurance through companies, do you think the country is ready for, if not a single-payer system, at least some kind of reforms of the system? When we have about 45 seconds.
I don't think anybody denies that we need to reform the healthcare system. We need to fix the health insurance markets. We've got to make the inequities of the tax code. We have to stop the penalization of people who buy health insurance on their own, and we have to directly help low-income people get private health insurance. But if I were to tell my congressman anything, I would tell my congressman one thing. Give me my personal freedom. Do not interfere with my personal freedom. And at the end of the day, individuals and families should make the key decisions in the system, not the government.
Well, much more to talk about, and I appreciate both of you joining us today on Radio Times. Robert Moffitt, thank you very much.
Welcome.
And Steffi Wohlhandler, thank you very much as well.
It's been my pleasure.
And Robert Moffitt, director of the Heritage Foundation Center for Health Policy Studies. Steffi Wohlhandler is a founder of Physicians for a National Health Program. She serves on the board, also a practicing physician and associate professor of medicine at Harvard University. Appreciate your phone calls to Radio Times. Drop us an email. Go to whyy.org/Radio Times. Tell us what you thought of our show today. We'd like to hear from you. I'm Marty Moss-Cohen, and you're listening to WHYY-FM Philadelphia, your member-supported news and information station serving Pennsylvania, New Jersey, and Delaware. And do stay.